ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Continuing Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 21, Explanation of the Vedic Path, Text 24. Utpadyeva hikameshu, praneshu svajaneshu cha, Asakta manaso matya, atmano nata hetushu, utputyaiva hikameshu, praneshu na janeshu cha, asakta manaso matya, atmano nata hetushu, utputyaiva hikameshu, praneshu svajaneshu cha, asakta manaso matya, atmano nata hetushu, utpatyaiva. Simply by birth. He. Indeed. Kameshu. In objects of selfish desires. Praneshu. In vital functions. Such as one's duration of life. Sense activities. Physical strength. And sexual potency. Svajaneshu. In his family members. Cha. And asakta manasa, having become attached within the mind. Matya, mortal human beings. Atmana, of their real self. Anatta, of defeating the purpose. Hetushu, which are the causes. Translation. Simply by material birth, human beings become attached within their minds to personal sense gratification, long duration of life, sense activities, bodily strength, sexual potency, and friends and family. Their minds are thus absorbed in that which defeats their actual self-interest. Purport. Please repeat. Simply by material birth. Human beings become attached within their minds to personal sense gratification. Long duration of life. Sense activities. Bodily strength. Sexual potency. And friends and family. Their minds are thus absorbed in that which defeats their actual self-interest. Purport. Our attachment to the material body and the bodies of family and friends inevitably leads to unbearable anxiety and suffering. The mind absorbed in the bodily concept of life cannot possibly advance in self-realization, and thus one's hope for an eternal life of bliss and knowledge is defeated by the objects of one's so-called affection. Activities performed in ignorance are beneficial neither for oneself nor others. Just as the charitable activities one may perform in a dream bestow no tangible benefit on real people. The conditioned soul is dreaming of a world separate from God, that any advancement experienced in this dream world is merely hallucination. The Lord states in Bhagavad Gita, Sarva Loka Maheshwaram, He is the supreme enjoyer and Lord of all planets and worlds. Only by Krishna consciousness, recognition of the supremacy of God, can one make actual progress in life. Om Magyana Tinarandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshura Militam Jena Tasmaya Sri Guru Pahinamaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stavitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Urkatama Jandadati Swahapadantekam Panchakopta Rubya Shakripa Sindhavi Evata Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So Annie Ruda asked me just as I was walking out the door at 6:45 to be on standby. So here I am. Guru Maharaj is not feeling well. So I came over and I read this verse. And I was immediately reminded of a play that was done here in the 80s. Now, it would involve some devotees that you perhaps now know in a more sober mood in their current positions. So Bhakta Prabhu was the leading role in the play. And the opening scene, you might remember this, Hansel and Gretel. What an image, huh? What an image, the opening scene. Anyway, so the scene opens, the curtains are all closed, and there's all this clanging and banging and falling sounds and everything, simulating the soul's fall into material existence. And then the curtain opens and there's this baby crying. Now we all know how big Bhakta Prabhu is, right? So imagine this giant crib on the stage with Bhakta there, these big feet sticking up, wobbling like this. He's got his baby bonnet on and a big dummy in his mouth. Screaming like a newborn child. Right. Anyway, I read this first line of the purport, and this was the first image that came to mind. This is our birth in material existence. It was quite a vivid portrayal. And then, of course, the parents come and all the relatives and everything, and they start, you know, poking and playing and, you know, reinforcing an identification with something that we are not. Huh? So, association with all these family members, which we associate with for this lifetime, and maybe by attachment we associate with for a number of lifetimes. But these relationships, you know, the Bhagavatam, I think somewhere describes, that it's like, you know, straws meeting in a stream. You know? So we have all seen, you know, watch the stream, and, you know, there may be twigs or straws floating on the stream, and sometimes they might just come together and travel down the stream for a little bit, and then after a while the current separates them. So our family relationships, our relationships that we experience in this material world, that somehow or other we become very, very much attached to, are compared to this. You know, there's no real connection. Other than, you know, for a while we're sort of rubbing up against each other or travelling along the same path, but then after a while, just like, I mean, when we're children, we live with our parents and basically we do what our parents do. But I haven't done that for 35 years, basically. Now and then, you know, we met. So when we're children, you know, when we're more dependent, you know, we're doing what our parents do, where our parents take us, where our parents send us to school, where our parents take us to live, you know, what sports teams our parents enroll us in, etc., etc. So at that time, we were very much dependent on, you know, family and friends, and, you know, for how we construct our life. But then after a while, you know, just like it's the independent nature of the jiva to actually take birth in this material world in the first place. You know, that as we grow up, our independent nature starts to manifest more and we somewhat separate ourselves. You know, that we might maintain some connections, but by and large we separate ourselves and go and make our own lives and make other friends and make our own families, etc., etc. And so this is material life. So what are we doing in this life, really? What do they say in the purport here? This attachment to the material body and the bodies of family and friends inevitably leads to unbearable anxiety and suffering. Just like we heard the other day. Oh, Prabhupada was discussing, you know, in Burijan Prabhu's
class, that 5 minutes from the Maipur class in 1976, that when the child is suffering, who feels more anxiety and pain? The child or the parent? It's the parent. It's the parent who has affection and love for the child. So in this way, you know, because of these associations and attachments that inevitably develop, you know, we suffer so much anxiety. You know, I know I've suffered so much anxiety for my children when they've been sick, or so many things I could. No need to elaborate. You worry for your children because you feel responsible for their welfare, and when they're in a difficult situation, or when they're suffering or missing or whatever, you worry for them. It's natural. You know, there's attachment there. We lost Tara one time when we were in Vrindavan. Tara was 6.5 years old. She's now 21. And she was just 6.5 years old, and we were at Radharaman temple. And we'd just been given some Mahaprasad and Likir in the little cups. And we came out of the temple, and Jasoda was there, and she had to take Dhananjaya. He needed to go and attend to some business. He had a belly bug. So Jasoda raced off with Dan to find a toilet, and Tara was walking with me, but then she raced off following her mother, and I went round to Gopal Bhatta Goswami's temple, his samadhi round the side, because I thought, Tara's gone with her mother, so I've got some time on my own, so I just went around there. And and then when Jasoda came back with Dan, she didn't have Tara. So Tara had raced out and not found her, and because she was holding Dan's little pot of kheer as well, so she had the two. So anyway, she hadn't found Dhananjaya and Jasoda. So and we didn't know where she was. We just didn't know where she was. This was a Sunday in Vrindavan. It was busy like anything, with pilgrims from Rajasthan all over the place, busloads and busloads of pilgrims from Rajasthan and whatever. And we're just running around the streets looking for, we went back into the temple, nobody's seen her there. We went out in the streets, anybody seen a little girl like this? Nobody. Of course in India they say, yeah, she went this way, or and you ask the next person, she went that way. And so we're running around all over the place, and after about half an hour I eventually went to the police station, because where's my little girl? Just all sorts of imaginations, it's the mention of hallucinations, all sorts of imaginations of being whisked off to Rajasthan to become a servant in somebody's house or something, I don't know. Just all sorts of weird things going through your head for that half an hour or so. So eventually we went to the police station and said, look, I can't find my little girl, don't know where she is, where did you last see her, da-da-da. So anyway, we walk all the way back to Radharaman via the other the other post where some police are. Anyway, so when we get back, this is about an hour later, and one of the Goswamis at the temple walked out with her. Jasoda had come back and she was there, and I just erupted at that point in time. But what had happened was, she was coming out and she was holding these two pots of kheer, and the monkey jumped out and snatched them out of her hand, and she still describes the feeling of those hands on her hands, all slimy monkey hands, like that. And she just completely panicked and ran back to the temple, and didn't quite know where she was. And I don't know if many of you have been to Radharaman temple, but behind the deities are here, then you've got the mandap, and then you've got a platform at the back where the bhajan band plays. Behind that, there's a wall. And between the wall of where the bhajan band plays and the wall of the compound, there's about this much space. So she ran down the back of that and was leaning on the wall just sobbing. And Suman Goswami, one of the older Goswamis in the temple, had found her like that, and she was crying. And so they'd taken her into her house, and they were offering her, trying to look after her, and offering her yogurt, and she wouldn't take anything from My kids were really strict. They really impressed people when they went to friends' birthday parties. They wouldn't take anything in case it wasn't bona fide or something like that. You know, so because they didn't know these people, I mean, they've got lifetimes and lifetimes of heritages, you know, Paka Vaishnavas, so of course they're offering bona fide prasadam. But anyway, just an example of, just how anxious you can become for your children because of attachment. You know, here I am, completely a doting father, so attached to my kids, and this is the situation. But anyway, they looked after, and Tara became quite attached to Radha Raman for some time as a result of that. But it was quite an anxious time, and there are many other incidents on that trip in particular, because we took young kids to India. So it was, a very anxious time. So there's so much anxiety. And when the mind becomes anxious like that, then it's just like, when we did the japa workshop with Guruji Prabhu, a couple of months ago, there's a lot of emphasis on focusing the mind, and keeping the mind just focused on, just simplifying its focus. Because when the mind is going here, there and everywhere, Arjuna, describes to Krishna, so many aspects about the mind. Chanchalam himana Krishna balavad. That is flickering, it's obstinate, it's very strong. It wants to go here and there and there and the other place as well and wherever. I think it was Gangeshwar said, the mind will take us anywhere but Krishna, basically. Isn't it? So this is the nature of the mind, because the mind is very much connected to our senses. Often the mind is referred to as the sixth sense. So all our desires for sense gratification and the pushings of the senses are actually promoted by the mind. The mind thinks so many things and becomes influenced by so many things, and therefore the senses are pushed and dragged all over the place. We've seen that picture of the chariot in the Bhagavad Gita, right? Where with the five horses, the senses, and the reins. So sometimes the senses are out of control, and then you get reference to the unbridled mind when the senses are out of control. When the mind isn't held tightly and directed by the intelligence, which is in turn being directed by the super soul beside us, then the mind becomes unbridled and the senses are just running amok here and there and everywhere. So this is material existence. So this is what we're born into. So back to the play. The play was very much exemplifying this. So Bhakta beyond the baby was a big strapping German lad, Hansel. So the play was Hansel and Gretel. So he had, you're from Holland, right? So these shorts that they wear over there? The leather shorts with the straps?
That's German.
German, yeah. But yeah, same part of the world. So that was Bhakta's coat. That's what he was wearing. So his big long legs and these little short leather pants and the... So here was Hansel, and then Ayodhyadeva was Gretel, and so here they were in the forest of material enjoyment, was the analogy. And of course, we know that the Christian Andersen story of the gingerbread house and everything else like that. So the gingerbread was the allurement of material energy. It represented the allurement of material energy. And who do you think might have played the witch, Maya? You remember? No, it wasn't Balaram. It was our dear friend Aniruddha Prabhu. He's got the nose for it.
Right.
Hare Krishna. Sorry, Annie. he was a great Maya devi, Maya witch, And he'd be there.
Hello, come to the gingerbread house, you can enjoy.
Like this, so it was quite funny. It was very funny, actually, it was a very funny play. So anyway, this was the thing. So this is material energy. There's so many temptations, abounding, and to distract the mind. So the point being made in this verse in the purport is that these things, although they appear to offer us, what do they call here? Hope for an eternal life of bliss and knowledge, You know, all these things, all these allurements to enjoy now. You know, they offer us, they appear to offer us that, you know, that happiness, that enjoyment. But actually, really, they don't. Really, they don't. You know, Prabhupada would often say, well, you know, how many chapatis can one man eat? Two, three, four, and then, you know, what more can he do? So, you know, just similarly, the sugar candy of this material world, you know, how much can we actually enjoy before it starts making us suffer, before it makes us sick? You know, we all know if we eat too many gulabs or whatever, or too much sweet rice, you know, we might suffer for a little while after that, even though it's prasadam or whatever, because we're actually trying to enjoy it through our material body. Unlike Mahaprabhu, you know, who could eat, you know, truckloads of prasadam, and said, you know, that they would fill the house with offerings to him, and he would eat it all, he would consume it all, because he's the Supreme Personality. You know, and Jagannath, he eats what, 54 offerings a day. So this is the Supreme. But you know, when we try to enjoy even prasadam through our material bodies, it's limited, because our bodies are limited. There's limited capacity. You know, we all know, you know, we all experience, you know, when we try to do something, whether it's enjoyment or whether it's service or whether whatever it is, we have limitations. It's only, you know, even though we may say, well, you know, I wish I could, you know, distribute 100 books, or you know, serve some more, you know, Rupa Goswami praise, you know, I wish I had 1,000 ears so I could hear, you know, Krishna Katha more and more and more and more. I could hear the Lord's name more and more. So we have so many. Might have so many aspirations, you know, all expressions of the material body. You know, the gopis curse Lord Brahma because he created eyes with lids that have to flicker now and then. Now, if we all blink, you just blinked, right? How much vision did you lose, actually, when you blinked? You just did it again. How much vision do we lose when we blink? We barely notice it, right? I can look at Mahatma there and blink, and I didn't notice that I wasn't seeing him, right? Isn't it? So the you know about eyes and ears and things like this, right? So the blinking of the eye, I mean, it just helps the eye sort of maintain itself and everything. It's part of the design. It's actually perfectly designed like that. But the gopis curse that, you know, Brahma created an eyelid that blinks, because, you know, it disturbs their darshan of their Lord, you know. Yeah? But yeah, when we blink, you know, we don't notice that actually, you know, that our vision is shut for a moment, just like the shutter on a camera, you know, that our vision is shut for a fraction like that. But the gopis, you know, they're so focused on, you know, on Shyam, on Krishna like that, you know, they're just so focused that is a disturbance to them. To that. So that's their attachment to Krishna. You know, we come in and, you know, there's Krishna. Oh, yeah, what's next? You know, like that. And it was a case you said last week. You know, we should drink deeply, you know, darshan of the deities here. But, you know, we take a quick darshan and then head for the Charanamrita. Right? Mm-hmm. He made that point last week. Right? So the material body, you know, and our material activities, even though there's so much promise of enjoyment and really is a false promise like that. So actually this material condition, it reinforces a false sense of self, just like we described when the baby was first born. You know, you know, we're given a name, we're introduced to all, you know, relatives and so many behaviours and so on. Not necessarily, you know, in relation to our true self or to our ultimate benefit. You know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, for example, he prayed that he could take birth, you know, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, even as an ant or, you know, some other insect or whatever, if was in the house of a devotee. If it is in the house of a devotee. Because in the house of a devotee, one's natural position is reinforced. One's real position is reinforced. You know, the devotee, even though you may be an ant, the devotee sees you as jiva, part and parcel of Krishna, and treats you that way. There's one little story I heard yesterday listening to Prabhupada on my way out to meet up with Bhakta Prabhu, and a little bit of a different context, but the point is there's a story of a brahmana, and he sees a scorpion in a puddle of water, and because he's compassionate, you know, his nature as a brahmana is compassion and, you know, concern for the welfare of all living beings, he picks the scorpion out of the water, you know, because, you know, the scorpion can't struggles in water, so he picks the scorpion out of the water, and of course, what does the scorpion do? And he goes, oh, you know, and his friend says, so what did you do that for? You know, and then and again he sees, you know, he sees another, yeah, he does this a number of times, you know, and his friend says, he does it again, you know, and the scorpion bites him, you know, the other scorpion bites him, and whatever, and his friend says, so why did you do that? You knew he was going to bite you. And he said, well, it's my nature, you know, I'm brahminical, I feel compassion and welfare for all living beings. So it's my nature, I have to do like that, you know, just like Krishna says to Arjuna, you know, it's your nature to fight. Whether you fight under my direction or not, you know, you might go away and think you're going to, you know, just take a path of austerity and meditation instead of engaging in this battle. But you will fight. It is your nature. You'll find somebody to fight with. It is your nature. So better you fight. So, you know, just like, you know, Krishna is pointing out to Arjuna that you will behave according to your nature. So, you know, the Brahmin says, you know, how can I help it? This is my nature. I must do this. I'm just simply behaving according to my nature. Similarly, it is the nature of the scorpion to bite when he feels, you know, threatened or whatever. So, you know, he doesn't know what I'm going to do. So he just bites. He's behaving in his nature. So what is there to criticize? I'm behaving according to my nature. He's simply behaving according to his nature, the nature associated with your body. So material nature is like that. You know, we are forced to act according to the body we have. So this is our nature. Why was I saying that?
You're saying it because of the note to cooperate.
Yeah, that's right. He would you know, happily take birth as an ant. Of course, then he would get the crumbs of prasadam, the remnants that fell on the floor and like that as well. He wouldn't have to go looking very far for his sustenance. So he'd be getting prasadam. He'd be, you know, safe. You know, he would be, you know, in the hands of a devotee. I once saw this when Jagadish was staying at our house at Nindagram, maybe in the early 90s. And he went to take his bath in the morning, and he called me. He said, Virabhadra, can you give me a piece of paper? So there was one of those daddy longleg spiders in the shower cubicle, and he wanted to lift him out before he took his bath so he didn't flush him down the drain. You know, like that. So the devotees, they have this compassion like that. So this is devotees, but they, because they are seeing actually that all living entities are part and parcel of Krishna, they're not seeing that this is, you know, a scorpion who's going to bite. They're seeing a servant of Krishna. They're seeing all living, you know, they see all living entities as part and parcel. They see equally, whether one is, you know, a dog, a dog eater, an elephant, a brahmana, you know, they see like that. So this is the real condition. Whereas, you know, when we're born, our family members and friends see us as, you know, their cute little darling boy and so on. Therefore, you know, that becomes reinforced in our consciousness when we were born, you know, as children. And then we meet friends and so on like that, and we, you know, and so many upadis are created, you know, so many false identifications. You know, how we, you know, you join a sports team and, you know, and then you might become the captain of that team, or, you know, or you're identified with a particular position you play on the field, or whatever, you know. And so many different identifications are there, you know, through, and in this way our material life becomes conditioned, conditioned, conditioned. And if by some good fortune, you know, we're wandering about in this universe or many universes, Ramanda Brahmate Kom Bhagavan Jeev. So if by some Bhagavan Jeev, Kom Bhagavan Jeev, if somehow we become fortunate, Guru Krishna Prasade Poi, we get the mercy of Guru and Krishna. Like that. And then our identity begins to develop. The seed of love of God is planted, Bhakti Lata Beach, like that. So that is real fortune. That is our benefit. Otherwise everything is misdirected. As it is said here. If our minds are absorbed in all the things associated with the body, and it says here, what's the word for it? Praneshu. Kameshu praneshu. Become absorbed in these things. You know, having a long life, engaging in various sense activities, maintaining the body strong, being sexually potent and everything else like this, and having so many friends and family. And these are all distractions to our true self. I mean, they're all useful if they can be directed, right? It's like the activities of the senses. That's the first guy. Rishikena Rishikesha Sevamukhehi Jivado. If the activities of the senses are engaged in the surface of the master of the senses, then that is correct placement of that energy. If they're engaged in our sense gratification, or the sense gratification of friends and family, like that, we might develop an attitude of being charitable or compassionate or in service to others. But that's simply an extension of our own false identification. And actually ignorant of what is the real benefit, and ignorant of their true selves and our true selves. So it's ignorant of that. So the purport here mentions that activities performed in ignorance are beneficial neither for oneself nor others. And it mentions charitable activities one may perform in a dream. They have no tangible benefit on real people. The people we see in a dream, even though they may be people we recognize in the dream, they're not real. And the activity in the dream is not real. So the comparison is here that, in this dreamlike state in our material existence, the results of our activities are not real. In the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, this is described the qualities of Sat and Asat. Sat, we know, means eternal, but it also means, in the context of that verse, it means that which has substance, which is real. And Asat, if it is temporary, it has no substantive reality. Krishna describes that the sages have concluded this by studying the nature of both, that things of this temporary material world have no reality, whereas things of an eternal nature, that are of a spiritual nature, they are real because they endure like that. So this is the condition, this is the knowledge that we have to come to. So just like even charitable activities in ignorance, Krishna describes in the 17th chapter the different forms of charity and activities that one may perform, presumably for the benefit of others. Charity is considered to be noble and pious and whatever else, but if it is not performed in proper knowledge, then it actually has limited benefit. So if particularly charity in the mode of ignorance, what does Krishna say here? Charity performed at an impure place, at an improper time, to an unworthy person, or without proper attention and respect, is said to be in the mode of ignorance. And this has, Prabhupada mentions here, such charity is not beneficial, rather sinful persons are encouraged.
Similarly, if a person gives charity to a suitable person but without respect and without attention, that sort of charity is also said to be in the mode of darkness. So it's not actually benefiting the ultimate self-interest of the living being that any of these activities defeat that self-interest, it says here. Anatta hetushu. Atmana anatta hetushu. It's defeating the real self-interest of the living beings. Like that. So it doesn't help. So whatever austerities we perform, like that, they should be done for the benefit of Vishnu or Krishna. Whatever offerings we make, is it jat karoshi, jat asnasi, jat tapasyasi, tapuntaya? What's the next bit? Anyway, whatever activities one performs, whatever austerities one may perform, whatever offerings in charity, they should be offered to Krishna. Prabhupada mentions in it here, Sarvalok Maheshwaram. So this Bhaktaram Jagyatapasam. Krishna is the proprietor, he is one that all jagyas are meant to be performed for. Sarvalok Maheshwaram. He is the proprietor of all planets and demigods. So everything should be offered to him. And the next line, Suridam Sarvabhuta. Suridam. He is within the heart as the benefactor of all living beings. Matyatva Shantim Richasi. So one who knows this and acts on this platform, he is peaceful. He is peaceful. Right? Not like, it's described here that, one behaving without this knowledge, thinking himself, the enjoyer of the sacrifice or the beneficiary, that this is meant for me. Just like the child in the toy shop, he sees all those things and they think they're meant for his enjoyment. Because that's the promotion, they see the advertising and everything. So when they go to the shops, they're pulling on their mother's skirt or whatever, can I have that? Can I have that? Can I have that? So we think it's meant for us, and we think the world owes us so much. Even sometimes we think the temple owes us so much. I've done years and years of service. Why aren't they looking after me? You think Krishna, Prabhupada would say, you think Krishna can't look after you? He's feeding a big elephant every day. And elephants eat tons of, not one big elephant, but, thousands and millions of elephants he's feeding. I know. You come to Melbourne Temple and you don't go hungry, right? Isn't it? I read on one brochure yesterday that I think Bhakta Prabhu had for the Parliament of World Religion, that Melbourne is the prasadam distribution capital of Australia, isn't it? So there's no shortage of prasadam in Melbourne Temple. So it's a good place to surrender to Krishna. You look after him. So anyway, Krishna is the recipient of all jagyic sacrifice. All jagyic is meant to be performed for him. And he is the proprietor and the lord of all planets and demigods. He is the supreme lord like that. But then also, he is the benefactor of all living beings. So when all sacrifice is offered to the supreme lord, then actually everybody benefits. Just like when Draupadi fed Krishna, whatever scrap was left in the corner of the pot, when Devasa was and all these 10,000 followers were just, off taking bath before they were to come and, take prasadam with Draupadi and the Pandavas. And so just like when Krishna took that by mystic potency, Devasa and all these men sort of felt embarrassingly satisfied that they couldn't come back to the camp of Draupadi for lunch. Because Draupadi had no lunch because, she had this pot that, once she ate,
You know, she could cook and, you know, she could feed unlimitedly from this pot. She had this benediction. But once she ate, then it was finished. So she'd just taken her prasad just before Devasa turned up, so there was nothing left. And she was in anxiety how she was going to feed Devasa and his 10,000 disciples because, you know, according to, you know, Vedic injunction, one should receive a guest and should treat them very nicely and feed them and so on like that. You know, this is the etiquette. But how is she going to do it? You know, she'd used up all the bhoga, you know, she'd just taken her lunch, she had no means of doing it. But it was just, so Krishna came and saved her in this way because he was satisfied, then everybody else is satisfied like that. So Krishna is the recipient of all jagic sacrifice, but in that, you know, everybody benefits. When we serve the Supreme Lord, everybody benefits like that. So this is actually our real self-interest. It's not to serve our senses, but it's to serve the master of the senses, Hrishikesh. And when we do that, you know, our senses are naturally satisfied. It's, you know, it's such a, you know, a wonderful and simple and effective process. So he is the supreme enjoyer. And then this final line of the purport: only by Krishna consciousness, recognition of the supremacy of God, can one make actual progress in life. Any other endeavor doesn't recognize this simple point is useless. Right? Prabhupada would often say, you may have so many material assets, so many material abilities, so many material facilities, all zero, worthless, totally worthless in terms of one's real interest. Unless and until you put Krishna at the front. And we know what one in front of a lot of zeros equals. Lots. You know, lots and lots of value. Who's the treasurer? When we have lots of digits after the one in front, but who else does it? Not Nandamandi. Mataji.
Treasurer.
Mata. What's her name? Anyway, any Rishi's got one. Mataji holds with the treasury as well. Anyway, somebody. Mm-hmm. Starts with M, I'm sure. Anyway, it's not here. So, but you know, when you've got lots of digits, you know, offered in front of Krishna, we have, just like we read the score. So, you know, I mean, because we offer to Krishna, there's value, but otherwise, what is the use? It's like, you know, we're hearing about the gold standard, the silver standard. Was that in class? Or did I hear that somewhere else? Gold standard, silver standard. Yeah, Gangeshwar was saying, I think. Now we have the silver standard. Now we have the gold standard. Maybe it was a tape I was listening to.
Maybe.
Yeah, must have been. Something else I was listening to. Ah, yeah. It was Burijan talking about Purikit Maharaj and the kingdom. So, when, you know, offering, when the, you know, governments are just printing money, just like last year, you know, we had so many, what was it? You know, economic stimulus packages going out. Basically, the government was running money off, and you know, for generations we're going to be paying it back because there's no gold to back it up. Really, they were just artificially stimulating the economy to keep people in work for a period of time till things picked up again. And you know, when it picks up again, we're going to have to pay it all back somehow. You know, and there are whole nations in the world at the moment, you know, totally in debt because they have no, you know, substantive gold reserves to back up their economies. You know, this one's borrowed off this one and that one's lent back to the other one. And, you know, so there's some nations in Europe that are, you know, actually totally, totally, totally bankrupt, but they've created this artificial economy where one's borrowed from the other and the other one's lent back to the other one and this and that. But it's just all, you know, shifting numbers on the page, you know, through cyberspace or whatever, however they do it. It's like we net bank, right? You know, we just go, you know, and we shift money over to here, there. But you know, really, it's just, you know, pushing a couple of buttons, and where's the money really? And you know, this speculative process of indulging in the stock exchange, you know, market, you know, stock markets go up and down, virtually on the whims of who's buying and who's selling and whatever else. But there's no real money involved as such. So this is the illusory, hallucinatory nature of the material energy. But when we actually put that, because it's ultimately all Krishna's energy. All these things that we are claiming and are sort of identifying within the material world, it's all actually Krishna's energy. And when we put it where it belongs, then its value, its real value manifests. So we put it in front of Krishna, we put Krishna in front of it, like the one in front of Prabhupada's zeros that he describes often. Then it has real value. And so similarly, when we put ourselves before Krishna, we have value. We put ourselves separate from Krishna, we then are in the asat situation. As long as we maintain independence of Krishna, we are asat. That which means we're in an unreality. And because it's based on a false identification of our actual position, who we really are, then it actually has no real benefit like that. And this is the gist of this verse, as I understand it. Simply by material birth, human beings become attached within their minds to personal sense gratification, long duration of life, sense activities, bodily strength, sexual potency, and friends and family. Their minds are thus absorbed in that which defeats their actual self-interest. And the last line of the purport, which is the conclusive statement of it. Only by Krishna consciousness, recognition of the supremacy of God, can one make actual progress in life. So is there any comment or question? Mahatmaji.
Thank you very much for a very nice and practical class.
Okay.
As you said, Mahaprabhu said, asatsam yava, ayadashram. You have to leave the bad company, asatsam.
Yes.
By that we can really advance very fast. That's my
very good point. So yeah, we have to. And therefore, practically speaking, Prabhupada would say that he set up this Krishna consciousness movement to provide that association. To provide that association. So that we can associate together, congregate together, hear about the Lord, and mould our lives in that way. This is the...
Another point Prabhupada is saying that you can have millions of dollars, but you can't enjoy it because you are slow. Yours,
because
so with material
thing
you can never
enjoy. Yeah.
You can only enjoy
Krishna. It's like the old bird in the cage play. This body is simply the cage. We're in this body like trapped, in a sense, like a caged bird, and we spend all our energy, and our friends and family spend all their energy hampering the cage without knowing the bird in the cage. Just like we have the analogy of the two birds in the body, right? So one of those birds is us. The other bird is Krishna, Sarit, our friend, just keeping by us there. So if, unless we actually nourish the bird, unless we actually nourish the soul, unless we nourish our true selves through activities that belong to that true self, then we are simply withering and dying. Even though we may externally think, oh, I'm enjoying so much, I've now got so much facility, and we aspire for so much, and this and that. Because I made this point one time before, during a Sunday feast class at New Governor, which somebody appreciated afterwards. So, just like when we're planning a holiday, and we're reading the brochures and we're looking at the place that we're going to go to, and we're thinking, oh, this is great. And of course, the postcard pictures or the promotional pictures show that destination at its best. The sky is blue, the sun is shining, even if it's a snowfield, So it looks, very attractive. Of course, then when you go there, it might be cold and raining and this and that, and things might not work out exactly. There was a mistake with the hotel booking, or, or something like that, or there was a, you know, the plane was delayed, or like when we were coming back from India in 95, you know, we got to Madras and we were lining up to check in, and we got to about three from the cash register, and they shut that from the booking, you know, check-in, and they just closed down and disappeared because they'd overbooked the flight by 70 passengers. Right, because the plane came from Bombay to Madras, and they put 70 extra people on at Bombay, so they couldn't put the people on at Madras to then go to Jakarta. So, and there it was, you know. We couldn't get on the plane. So, you know, so many things can go wrong. And, you know, and they put us up in a 5-star hotel for 2.5 days, but it was like prison. Because you couldn't go anywhere, and it was a weekend, and we were expecting to wash our clothes when we got to Jakarta. So we had all, because it was a weekend, there was no laundry service. So we washed our clothes in the bath and hung them outside, and we got into trouble for that because that wasn't the thing to do in your 5-star hotel. And we couldn't go anywhere because we had to wait around, because in the next hour they could tell us, oh, we've got a flight for you. So even though we were put in a plush 5-star hotel, and the kids were happy, they had, you know, nice beds and a television after, you know, 10 weeks in India. but it was like prison. It was like prison. So, you know, so whatever the situation in the material world, you know, it's like that. So anyway, we go on our holiday, and then you come back, and people say, how was it? And what do people usually say? It's all right. It's okay. Don't we hear that often? Whereas the week before they went, they were saying, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do that, and they get back, yeah, it's okay. So, you know, is the anticipation and the expectation actually satisfied in the actual event? Usually not. Often not. Right? So this is material endeavour. It's not actually satisfying. Anything else? Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much. And so I have a question. The first one is saying that material growth is actually, it's not a benediction, it's a curse. And again, it's attached to all these things. So wouldn't it be better?
Exactly what I was thinking of, yeah. So where do those other souls end up? What is compassion? Where do those souls go? They're lining up wanting to take birth, and you're saying, no, not going to do it for you. I'm a devotee, and I'm not going to let you come in my house. Because there's also that other Bhagavatam injunction that, you know, unless one can deliver their dependence, one should not become a guru, one should not become a father or mother, one should not become a teacher, one should not become any of these things. That injunction is there. And, you know, and I know of cases like this. I had a brother who was like this. He decided not to have children. He had a couple of stepdaughters. And, you know, and amongst the children of all his siblings, he was the favourite uncle. But, you know, he didn't have any children of his own. And he actually wrote like that, you know, this is the reason why, you know, I never had any children, but
this reason?
Well, he said he. Well, he had some other condition, and but yeah, in. How can I say? can I say, is he wrote this in his suicide note, basically, right? That this is a reason why he never had children, because he had some condition and, you know, and felt like he couldn't properly, you know, it wasn't proper for him to do like that. So sometimes that is there, but and we might think it's a noble thing, but the souls will take birth. If the souls are wanting to take birth, they will take birth, and so they will go somewhere. So, you know, you might be able to offer them a better situation than they may otherwise. You might be able to offer them a better situation than they might otherwise. What is the real... See, it's a curse, but it's a curse for the soul not to be able to take birth as well. Right? The soul needs to take birth, just like Arjuna needed to fight, just like the Brahmana needed to pick up the scorpion, and the scorpion needed to bite. You know, the soul needs to take... The conditioned soul needs to take birth somewhere, and he will. He will. So it's not an act of compassion, really, to say, well, I'm not going to have children because I'm not going to facilitate the curse of bringing one into material existence. Is that?
Yes, but then Krishna says that then would be right, and should promise us to be practicing for rest and chanting Krishna. So at some point, all of us will go back to Krishna. Really, this is our aim, right? And but if we go going back, then we go back to Godhead and we don't fall down again, right?
Yeah.
But this circle, it seems not to stop ever. Like before, you're saying that the soul that they still need to take birth, need to take birth.
Yeah.
But they're all going back to them.
Well, that's where they belong. We're all part of Krishna. We are all
yeah,
original.
But then why doesn't it stop? Why won't it stop? Like all the time, because the souls are unlimited or not?
Souls are unlimited, yes. Souls are unlimited. Krishna's energy is unlimited. Souls are unlimited. Desires of the soul are unlimited, practically speaking. Mm-hmm. Somebody knows. And did you want to add something?
No, I was thinking about Srila Prabhupada just explained that because we're a marginal potency, so we either have the choice to directly serve Krishna in the spiritual world or become attracted to Krishna's external energy, in which case we have the nature body and the nature siddha devotee. So the material world is created and is facilitating our concocted desire.
Mm.
But within that as well, these desires of course push us to take birth, but if we've perfected our sadhana, then we go back to the spiritual world. So the material world will always be there, just that the society will be a little prison house, because there will be a majority who, you know, they don't want to obey the rules of the Lord. So they'll be a minority who want to be in the material world, and the majority of the soul will be in the spiritual world. So there will always be certain living entities who will be going through this cycle of birth and death.
Hmm. And if they're not in the material world, then it's a period of time of, you know, when the material world is not manifest, and then they're within the body of Mahavishnu, and then when he breathes again, those, you know, so there's... It's because Krishna and all his creations, this actually goes on eternal. But you know, jivarat rupoy Krishna nichadas. We, you know, our position is actually the eternal nature of the jiva is to be an eternal servant of Krishna. The second half of that verse, Krishna tatasta shakti beta beta prakash. So as Maharaji was saying, you know, we are part of Krishna's shakti, we are his energy, we are tatasta shakti. And so that line means we can go, it just depends which way we look. You know, we can look towards Krishna and be attracted that way. Or if somehow, though, we don't know how it is we make that choice, but we make that choice and we look the other way from that thin imaginary line, the tata, that is where the tatasta shakti, that shakti of Krishna, you know, is situated, and then, you know, somehow or other, it It's an untraceable point in time when we made that choice, because, you know, it appears, practically speaking, you know, that, you know, we're eternally conditioned. But there is opportunity to become eternally liberated also, if we become fortunate and take advantage and know how to use that fortune. It's no good giving, you know, somebody $1 million if they don't know how to use it. And sometimes we see this, you know, with people that win lotteries. 3 years later, they're bankrupt, because they get money, they get a lot of money artificially, and they don't know how to use it. So we have to not only get the mercy of Guru and Krishna, but we actually have to know how to receive it and how to use it. And then we can behave properly. And part of that using it is sharing it. And if that means giving other living entities a similar opportunity to what we have, whether by cultivation and preaching or by birth or whatever, then that's part of our role. But you don't have to do that. Yeah, you don't have to do that. That's up to you. It's a big issue, actually, you know, what we do with energy. And it's, you know, in the Kaviraj Goswami describes in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that the storehouse of love of God, it is not a limited thing. When Mahaprabhu came, it said he plundered it, you know. And so when we think, when we hear the word plunder, we might think, you know, and treasure chests, you know, we get images of pirates, and they take the treasure and nobody else has got it. But the treasure house of love of God is of a different nature. It is unlimitedly expanding. It is not in a, you know, it's not finitely limited like material wealth or material energy. So when the nature of spiritual energy, the more you delve into it and the more you distribute it and share it and whatever, the more it increases. It's unlimited like that. So the storehouse, it's got, you know, it's a very nice image. The storehouse of love, you know, that Lord Mahaprabhu and Nityananda, they plundered the storehouse of love of God, and in this plundering it was unlimitedly expanding. It's described, Mahaprabhu delivered the whole universe practically. Yet we're still here. But we're liberated because we're in his shelter.
On that point of perfection, Srila Prabhupada said, has given us so much mercy, even if we are 70% perfect, we can still go to spiritual birth. We don't have to be indulgent. Prabhupada has given so much mercy,
yeah,
and we give so much of it. 16 down, four liberated.
He said, I've read purports where he actually said that, and I've heard say, you just do this, I personally will come and take you.
Yeah.
If you can just do this.
Yeah. So we don't have to worry about perfection.
Of course, whatever else we do develops our relationship with Krishna and, you know, what our swarup will be.
Yeah.
So whatever else we do. But just do this and I'll take you back to Godhead. Yeah.
We are only hoping for
I've heard Bhurijan Prabhu quote, one disciple of Prabhupada was writing that I'm having difficulty with just these four things, and, you know, or one of these four things or something like that, you know, just, you know, what to do. Because Prabhupada responded differently at different times, but this one stuck in my mind because of the way, you know, Bhurijan Prabhu recited it. He said, Prabhupada's response was, but you promised. So, and he promised also. So if both promises are kept, as you say, then
good chance. Very good chance.
Yeah. We have to keep our end of the bargain also. Alright. All the way to Srila Prabhupada.
Yes.
Okay.